Is this thing on? Hey, how's it going, everybody? I'm Bobby Watts, and welcome to the High Voltage Podcast. Really excited to be here, really excited to be doing this. This is great. I've been wanting to do this for quite a while. I wanted a platform to take all of my interests and all the things that I've learned throughout the last, 10 years of working on my own and just bringing them together. I'm involved in so many different things, from radio controlled stuff, you know, radio controlled helicopters, to drones, to designing and manufacturing, to entrepreneurship, to business, you name it. I got tons of interests, and I wanted to just have a little place where I could bring everything together and have a platform to tell these really incredible stories from people that I've met along the way. I've had the really great pleasure of meeting so many cool people throughout doing this, and I just wanted to be able to share their stories, because some of these guys have some really incredible stories that I just think that more people should hear. In addition, I'm going to be able to throw up kind of whatever I want. This is going to be really informal. No two episodes are going to be the same. I think it's going to be a really good time, and I look forward to seeing where this goes. So it's 2018 right now. So hopefully this will be a very long journey, and hopefully, you know, as it progresses, I can take some of your feedback and see what you guys like, do a little bit more of that, try some different things. So it's really open, nothing too serious here, just sharing some stories. So with that being said, my very first guest that I wanted to bring on the podcast is my very good friend, Jordy Klein. And as you will hear, Jordy is absolutely a character, and I've learned so much from this guy. He got me into the aerial cinematography world, and I do all my drone shooting with him. So working with him and his company, XCAM Aerials, we've had the pleasure of filming for some of the top companies out there and worked with some really incredible people. Jordy probably has one of the most unique stories I've ever heard. And in this about an hour long interview, we barely skimmed the surface. So I'm going to have him back on here. But this interview is absolutely great. This is classic Jordy, and I hope you guys get a kick out of this. He's a really great guy, very knowledgeable, and definitely happy to have him on the show as my first guest. So Jordy actually got his start in the film industry with his father. His father is a two-time Academy Award-winning underwater cinematographer, and has worked on incredible projects such as the original Flipper TV series, The Abyss, James Bond Thunderball, some of the Jaws movies. I mean, he's a legend. He's an absolute legend. So that's where we're starting the interview, and I hope you enjoy this. So this is High Voltage, episode number one with Jordy Klein. Hope you enjoy it.
This is High Voltage with Bobby Watts.
Well, it's rolling. How you doing?
Just about right.
Just about right. Well, thank you for doing this. I definitely appreciate it.
Oh, well, I like to be appreciated. Is there a cough button? Because I have to clear my throat. I didn't know if they're like how the DJs have that mute for the cough thing.
No, we don't have that.
All right.
Well, I wanted to get you on as the first guest to my High Voltage podcast, because I couldn't think of anyone who kind of culminates a little bit of everything I do more than yourself. And I've met so many people that'll hopefully come on future episodes through you. And I think you and your family's story is the closest thing to Forrest Gump that I've ever heard.
Yeah. A lot of people have actually even told me in the past that maybe not Forrest Gump, but I remind them of Dustin Hoffman's character on Rain Man, only I'm not good in math.
Right, right. Well, as true as that may be, I think you and your family have a ridiculously cool story. And if you can think of any sort of historical event, your family's kind of been a part of it, if you think about it.
I don't know about that, but
you really have. You and your family have some really special things.
I mean, we weren't really involved with, like, my dad's days, like Watergate, and I wasn't really involved with, like, the Clinton Lewinsky thing.
Right, but you have a photo of you and your wife next to Trump.
Well, yeah,
from a dinner party.
Touche.
Right.
I guess you got a point
there. Right, and your mother met Hitler.
Yeah, gave him a flower, as a matter of fact.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like, your family history is just insane. Absolutely insane. But, okay, so I guess starting at the beginning. So you work in the film world full time.
You grew up doing that.
Yep.
Right.
I just thought that's what all every kid does.
But so, okay. So how'd you get into it? So your dad was in the film world and he got you into it?
I was born during the filming of the James Bond movie Thunderball.
So really? Okay. Yep. I didn't know that.
So, so I was literally born like a week before he started photography on it.
Wow.
And my my mom went to the Bahamas and stayed there, you know, in a hotel room.
As they were shooting.
Yeah.
Man.
With me.
That is so
cool.
So
that's how long I've been involved.
That's how long you've been doing.
And I was back then there was obviously they shot film. Mm-hmm. And as I grew up, when I was like 4 years old, my dad taught me how to load film in a film magazine for his movie camera. Mm-hmm. And I used to be able to zip myself into what they call the changing bags, which if you ever look at old movies like the behind the scenes, you had to put your arms in this black bag and then put the film in there and load the film magazine and then unzip it in.
Because it can't get
exposed to light. Or,
right, right.
Yeah, ruin it.
Right.
So I used to be able to fit inside the changing bag and I used to tie knots in the arms of the changing bags so I can get in there and load the film.
Right. No way. So you would yeah. climb in there and change it. That's so yep. awesome. So you grew up on film sets in the heyday of mm-hmm. of Hollywood. And so what... So I understand. So your dad was doing these really big feature films. So as you grew up, you worked with... I mean, there's photos here in your shop, by the way. We're here doing this at Geordie's compound. And there's photos with you with a young Tom Hanks and Ron Howard. I mean, you were on some really big sets even as a teenager, weren't you?
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's really weird because, you know, I learned how to scuba dive when I was like 2.5 years old. And, you know, he just basically put a tank on me and said, here, just breathe normally and don't hold your breath when you come up. That was the only advice I got. And
you turned out just fine.
Yeah. And I just, when I would go to school, I would just think that that's how...
That's like what every
other,
kid did.
That's what other kids, that's what you do.
Right.
And I would even like get in fights and stuff just because people just would not, you know, and even the teacher a couple times says, now, Geordie, you shouldn't be telling fibs now that you go underwater and you meet movie stars and this and that. And they even sent like notes home to my parents, you know, like, Geordie needs to learn to be truthful, more truthful.
You were lying.
Today he said that he met Mr. Sean Connery and that he was scuba diving and has pictures underwater with fish and this. And
wow.
So I just quit, you know, saying anything.
Right. Because I notice you're extremely humble. You're probably one of the more humble guys I've ever met. But you've met, I mean, so many and worked with so many famous people and famous
which but the famous
projects.
People aren't really the ones that I, you know, there's just a small handful of what I call famous people that I,
yeah, like who do you second. Get a kick out of, like when you met this person, like this person really was like, wow, like you looked up to him.
Well, or her. I'd say Ron Howard, because when we were doing the movie Splash, I was my dad's camera assistant. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, filming it, and they were filming a lot of the underwater scenes, which my wife was the underwater double for. I wasn't married to her at the time, but and they were having trouble with some of the underwater photographers, the additional ones.
Right.
And we were back in those days, you had to send the film off to get processed, and then it would get developed, and then it would get transferred to you know, a positive, because when you shoot, it's a negative. Mm-hmm. And then we would go to the theater, like they would rent a movie theater
really?
At night, and
that's
they
so
would
cool.
project your dailies. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they were called, the footage that you shot for the previous day.
And they still do that, by the way, when they're shooting movies. It's digital now, but
right,
they still go through it.
Sure, it's called digital intermedia, mm-hmm. Where they convert the video to. I mean, the film to video.
Sure.
But anyways, I would sit kind of in the back, and I would kind of just watch and listen, like what Ron and some of the other people were talking about. And we were watching this thing, And I felt so bad for some of these guys because, like, half their stuff would be out of focus. And I would just kind of feel for them. You know, I'd be, like, so embarrassed because, like, a lot of times they would shoot and the entire, like, we're shooting 400-foot rolls of film. Yep. And that's roughly a little over 4 minutes mm-hmm. on the screen. So sometimes the whole roll would be out of focus.
Oh.
And it's not like, you know, on your computer you can hit the scrub bar or something.
So you have to watch.
You just got
to
sit there and watch and watch. And I'm like, oh, man, this is bad.
Right.
So anyways, during one of these particular encounters, I heard Ron say, you know, maybe we should just let Jordy shoot this. I mean, how bad could it be? These guys aren't, you know. Like, he was real nice about it, but, you know, he just knew that I was always out putting out fires because even at that age, I was still a teenager, but I was, like, doing everything from helping the special effects guys to loading magazines to,
right.
you know, it's everything just because I'd been on movie sets my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gave me a chance, and I never looked back. You know, I ended up shooting for 6 weeks
Jeez.
On that movie and got called. Then after that, Ron Howard did Cocoon. I filmed on that movie. And then after that, he did a movie called Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
I filmed on that. And then I never heard from the guy again.
Really?
So I don't know what happened.
Well, he's made some good movies since then, if you go on.
But I think what happens is nowadays, I think the director of photography or the UPM, you know, unit production manager,
mm-hmm.
hires the camera department.
Sure.
So there's like a weird transition back then. I got a call to do that, the underwater scenes in the movie Backdraft from Ron.
Oh, wow.
But then he's like, well, we've got to let Simon, you know, he's the DP, this other guy.
Director of photography.
Yeah, we've got to let him decide who he wants to shoot it. And then he was an Australian guy, so he flew this other guy in from Australia to shoot it. So after that, I kind of didn't really work much with Ron anymore. But we still stay in touch. But,
that's so cool. Yeah. That's so cool.
But yeah, so that I would say Ron is one of my favorites. Yeah,
that's awesome. And so since your dad was underwater photography, you kind of came into the business being underwater photography, but now it seems to me that your specialty is pretty much anything besides putting a camera on a tripod.
Yep, I can't stand it.
So if you want to shoot something with a camera on a tripod, don't even call it.
Right.
Right. But anything else, underwater, right. in the air, moving 100 miles an hour, sliders.
On a boat.
Yeah, boat, cranes, yeah. like that's your specialty, right?
Yeah, yep. Anything besides conventional cinematography is right up my alley.
Right.
And stuff that other people don't like, usually.
Yeah, exactly. So I've had the pleasure of working with you for 12 years, 11, 12 years now.
Man,
11 years.
That's
crazy.
That long?
Yeah, I was a teenager when I met you. And the first time I ever met you, I was called down to Florida by I got into this film industry by flying RC helicopters, and I was flown down here to Jordy's house where we're actually right now, and in the middle of kind of nowhere in Florida, it's Summerfield, Florida, and the company that I was flying radio controlled aircraft for at the time, radio controlled helicopters, miniature aircraft, helped you build a custom RC helicopter that would carry. What kind of camera was it?
We originally flew a 35 millimeter film camera.
Really?
Called an IMO, which is held 100 a minute of film.
Nice.
And it had a little servo that would start it rolling. That's no stabilization. No,
right.
It was like in sure. like a hollowed out beach ball, you know, that would mm-hmm. would just with foam in it.
Yeah.
From there, the after that, we had another guy that we had flying at that time. He was a really good pilot, but I don't want to go into this whole thing, but we called him Sticky Fingers.
Okay.
And I think, I don't know, stuff would just come up missing all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
So he had to go.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So when I came down, I came down for a Sea-Doo shoot. So they flew me down to fly this RC helicopter that they customly built for you. It was a miniature aircraft, Ion.
Yes.
And we flew some sort of like pocket camera.
It was
a Canon something or another.
Some sort of a, yeah, I don't even remember.
And there was no stabilization.
It had a spinning mass gyro called a Kinyon.
No way.
Yeah, the big heavy thing. It probably weighed 4 pounds, right. Just the gyro. And it would spin up to like 50,000 RPMs.
Yeah.
And it was hung on bungee cords.
Oh, man.
And I mean, if I was looking at it the other day. It's on my Vimeo page.
Really?
And it looks pretty good.
I'll have to look.
There's moments. Yeah. There's definitely moments.
Yeah, exactly. So I came down and I remember the first thing I saw.
It's a helicopter.
It's a helicopter. We live near an airport.
Yeah.
So the first thing I saw was literally like you underwater with a camera, like upside down. You would like hold your breath and the boat would drive over you and you would film, you know, the boat and the wakeboarder going by. And I'm like, geez, this guy's nuts. And little did I know that only a few years later, I would come to work with you kind of full time, really. On your with your drones and your RC helis and stuff. So,
yep.
So how did you make the transition between underwater photography and then kind of really going to aerials and other specialties? Because that it seems to me like in the film world, once you get in one place, you're kind of locked in.
Yep.
So how did you wiggle your way out?
You're right. It is the film industry is super fickle when it comes to things like that because the mindset is. All right, this guy's really good at like Steadicam or underwater, so that's who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would you know there's perish the thought he would ever want to try to do something else.
Like right, right.
It, you know, film on land. You know, it's really weird. So I've been really fortunate in the fact that I was able to break that stereotype and be able to shoot above water and underwater.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that happened to me when I was really young was I blew both my eardrums several times.
Really?
From
diving?
From diving
so
and
much.
Stuff like that. And the thing is and most underwater photographers, serious underwater cinematographers, which mm-hmm. really there's only a handful in the world
mm-hmm.
that I would consider are professional underwater cinematographers have had to blow their eardrums on purpose because inevitably when you're filming for a month long,
mm-hmm.
you're going to get an ear infection. I just figured, man, I need to do other stuff too. Cause right about that time, you know, GoPros were coming on the scene and I could see the writing on the wall, you know, that those things were going to start getting better and they're turning still cameras into video cameras. And,
right.
And then I could also see that there are several people manufacturing and renting professional underwater movie cameras and renting them out to anybody that had the money.
And then...
So then all of a sudden, anybody that had a dive card
sure.
suddenly became a professional underwater cinematographer.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. So I could see the writing on the wall, so I figured, man, I better kind of broaden my horizons a little here and do... You know, I always loved flying, as my dad did too. Ever since I was a little kid, before I could even see over the dash of his airplane, I would just look at the instruments and fly.
That's so awesome. Because yeah, so you and your dad were both. So your dad's a pilot.
Yeah, he's a commercial helicopter pilot and owned a helicopter for years and was a cinematic helicopter pilot.
Wow.
And then he also shot with these old school helicopter mounts called Tyler mounts, which pointed out the side of the helicopter, and it was he shot for years doing that. So
sure,
that's where I just really loved doing that.
So you took your passion for flying, since you know you were flying since you were a kid. So in addition to underwater, you transitioned to aerials, right?
Mm-hmm.
So were you mainly flying or were you mainly the camera operator hanging outside a helicopter or shooting outside of a plane?
I was always the one shooting.
You're always the one shooting.
Because I am also a commercial helicopter and fixed wing pilot, but
right.
I have flown for a couple of jobs, but that is all getting out of the whole
right.
photography end of things.
Yeah. You're a bus driver at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even though, in my opinion, the helicopter pilot is the one that's actually doing the shot.
Right.
You know, basically the camera guy at that point is just along for the ride.
Yeah. But even a drone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The drone got to get it in frame.
Right.
Or got to get it in place. And
right.
Gimbal operator stays
I mean, the gimbal
in.
Operator has the easier job, in my opinion.
Sure.
In most cases.
Yeah, I think so. So I know through hanging out with you on these movie shoots, They're dangerous. There's no way around it. It's pretty dangerous. And we've, you know, through chatting with you so long, I know you've had a few close calls on some movie sets, let's just say, especially while being just hanging outside of a helicopter with your camera. So perhaps would you like to elaborate on when you're hanging out the camera, hanging out the helicopter with a camera experience?
Well, I always tell people that I'm not real smart, but I'm tough.
Okay.
That's always been my mantra.
Right.
So I've been in 3 helicopter crashes while filming.
3.
3, yes.
Not 1.
Not 2, not but 3.
3 like serious crashes.
Serious, where like helicopter completely destroyed.
Jeez.
And
unscathed. You're fine.
Within reason, yeah. I bumps and bruises, that type of thing, but unbelievably, I walked away from all of them.
Okay, so how do you even rate the top 3? So give us one. Just tell me.
All right, so
the story time with Jordy of being in a helicopter crash.
All right, like the first one was years and years ago.
Okay,
I was in my early 20s, and we were on an airport in South Florida, and we're getting ready to go film, I think, Hatteras Yachts, a commercial for them.
Okay.
And had my camera all set up on my Tyler mount, you know, this mount in the middle of the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And we took off, and there's one tree on the whole airport, little pine tree. And we took off, and the helicopter pilot, you know, backed up so we can get a running start to take off into the wind. And the tail rotor hit one of the branches on this tree. Backed right into it. Tail rotor came apart, started spinning around. He tried to put it down, but of course, you know what happens when you try to put a helicopter, even an RC helicopter, down with no tail rotor. It's
going to
go up and then dynamically roll over.
Oh,
and so, you know, made all kinds of racket.
And you just walked out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a jet helicopter, and the blades came off, and it flipped on its side, and it was just screaming. It was still running. Because, you know, he was on his side, and he couldn't really get to the throttle to turn it off. And I don't know if he was able to throttle it down, or if he just managed to reach the emergency fuel turn off or cut off. So
that's the first one.
The first one. But what's interesting is the guy was so pissed off that he walked into the hangar, you know, after he saw where I was okay, and walked out with an axe and manually chopped down the tree. in the middle of there.
That's awesome. That's great. But so I recall one of your other helicopter crashes involving you and water. It was over water.
Yeah, so that was
This is my favorite Jordy in a helicopter crash story.
This one was, and this is, you know, this several old time, this again, still in my 20s. All these happened when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
Back when I didn't really have any respect for, you know, if somebody would take me up, I would just go.
Sure.
So this guy, we in South Florida again, doing another boat commercial. He had this old, like 1940 something or 50 something. It was called a Hiller 112 or Hiller 12A, something like that. It's a, you know, reciprocating engine.
Okay.
Looked like one of those helicopters that you saw on the old MASH TV series.
Nice.
We took off, and this one I had no mount, you know, camera mount. I just stood on the skid with the camera on my shoulder, flying over, filming the boats. And there's always this one move that you know, you always want to try to get, which is what we call the wraparound move,
mm-hmm.
where the boat's doing 20, 30, 40 miles an hour. And, you know, you get that really cool 360-degree wrap around the boat, and then you pull out into the infinity,
and reveal the
whole
lake or whatever.
So yeah, everybody's seen it a million times every time you see a boat commercial.
Right.
So I said, okay, that's the shot I want. So this helicopter, being old, it was somewhat underpowered, and the boat was going downwind.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, when you do this maneuver, you want to be doing it into the wind, but I didn't. That was neither here nor there. This guy was probably in his mid-60s and figured he knew what he was doing.
So the pilot.
So the most critical part when you're doing this wraparound thing is when you're at a three-quarter front, you've got to put your tail into the, you know, downwind. Like, mm-hmm. So you're flying backwards with the wind.
Wow.
And that obviously that takes extreme amount of power.
Yeah.
To do that.
Sure.
And I could tell that he was pulling more collective than what the engine could.
Sure.
That's
so he was bogging it.
He was bogging it down. Kind of like putting it in fourth gear and going up a hill at 20 miles an hour. You know, it was like just with a stick shift car.
Right.
You know, it just didn't have. So normally what you would do is you would drop the collective, mm-hmm. let the rotor head build up speed, and then fly out of it.
Right.
But he kind of did what we call the deer in the headlights thing, where he just froze. And I swear, I was standing on the skid, and I could see the rotor, the blades going by, and actually could see detail on the tip of the rotor blades. And I'm like, there's no way we're getting out of this. So I thought, okay, and all this is going through my head at a million times a second.
How high were you at this point? Like, what was your altitude?
I asked people, and they said between 50 and 100 feet.
So you were low. Okay, you were really
low. I mean, if you consider 100 feet low.
Yeah. I mean, I would say so, yeah. Reasonable. Yeah,
I guess it's better than 1,000.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, so we're filming this boat, and the owner of the boat company was in the boat with these two models in bathing suits. And mm-hmm. So when this happened, I said, okay, to myself, I've got to either try to grab my camera, duck down, and dive back into the cockpit of the helicopter.
Right.
Or I got to jump out because we're not getting out of this. I could just tell there's no getting out of it.
And you're not strapped in?
No, just, I was just standing there, my left hand holding the bubble on the thing, my right hand holding the camera on my shoulder, leaning off the edge, filming.
No seatbelt, just holding
seat on. Seatbelt's for a sissy.
Right.
So I saw this, and I just said, well, we're going to go down. So I had headsets on, my wallet, cell phone, camera on my shoulder. I just took one big giant step right off the skid.
Straight into the water.
Yep. And it was the most surreal thing ever because literally as soon as I did that, I felt, the wind going past me and all of a sudden in the water.
Right.
And then I was standing on the bottom with the camera still on my shoulders, headset still on my head.
That's awesome.
The connector ripped out. But
of course.
But, it was like totally weird because literally I was 100 feet in the air. Now I'm 20 feet underwater. It's 22 feet deep. Jeez. There. I went right to the bottom.
Camera still in your hand.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And so I said, oh crap. So as soon as I realized, I put two and two together, I started swimming to the surface. Still camera on my shoulder. I don't know why I didn't drop the stupid thing, but I swam to the surface. As soon as my face broke the surface, the helicopter crashed right on top of me, and the blade hit so close to my face.
Jeez.
That the spray was like so intense that it put tiny little red marks all over my face.
Wow.
Because the spray was so intense.
How close was the blade to your face?
I don't know. I just felt this big thing and hit my face, and then I sunk back to the bottom. And
wow.
So then I'm like, oh crap, I'm starting to get running out of air.
Right.
So I don't know why I didn't drop the camera, but I still swam up to the surface. And as I'm swimming up, there's real dirty water there.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this big blob coming down towards me. And I kind of swam off to the side, and the helicopter floated right past me to the bottom.
Jeez.
And then so I come up, and by that time, the boat that we're filming comes up. And holy cow, there was pieces of the rotor blade stuck in the side of the boat.
In the boat?
In the boat. The models were crying, face was bleeding because, it had safety glass, the windshield.
Mm-hmm.
And a piece of the blade hit the windshield and shattered the glass, and all the glass hit their face.
Jeez.
And pieces of the rotor blade stuck in the side of this new boat.
Wow.
Like a $500,000 boat. And so the guy backs up to me and he's like, the guy's still down there.
So
the guy's still down there.
The pilot. Oh, man.
And so I handled my camera. I couldn't believe I still had the stupid thing. And I lost the headphones. I don't know. They fell off. So anyways, I dive back down there and I see the guy struggling to get out of the seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
And I reach down there and he's like, grabbing me, and I had hair back then. He's grabbing my hair and freaking out. So I get the seatbelt out, and and I get him out and swim to the surface, and he was puking up salt water. But anyways, he made it out.
But so if it would have been another cameraman, let's say, who wasn't as comfortable in the water, you think he would have made it?
You know, that's a really good question. Probably
did
not.
Did you save his life?
Because I had to have saved his life. And I've actually, I surf quite a bit too. And I've been out, and the same type things happen where the tourist swims out and it says dangerous rip currents.
Right.
But the tourists go out there and somebody's like, oh my gosh, my husband's out there on the Mickey Mouse float. Oh my gosh. And you see the guy out there flailing around, and I'm looking around, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. There's not a lifeguard.
And you have to go play.
And I have to go get him. And that was like I've came closer to dying rescuing like swimmers off the beach when I was surfing than I have any other time with like sharks, jeez, helicopter crashes, just because people grab you and try to pull you underwater and
man,
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that's... But anyways, so back to the helicopter thing.
Yes.
Yeah, we got him up, and then I got on the boat, helped the pilot up on the boat, and got up, and the owner of the boat company's like, oh, man, are you okay? I'm like, all right, so what's the next shot?
Of course you did. Of course. I like that. That's freaking awesome. So with all this helicopter filming, you used to... you know, just by hanging out the door. So now everything's been completely replaced by one or two things. Either like a remote head, so a helicopter still, but the camera is joystick control.
Gimbal, yeah.
Right, right. The camera is stabilized and you can remotely control it, or drones or multi-rotors, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point, so when I came in and started working with you in 07, at what point did you, like, what made you switch on to this RC fad? Because even in 07, we were flying helicopters with a camera. And then, you know, when I moved down here to Florida in late 2011, 2012, I started filming with you using RC helicopters, like a modified Align T-Rex, which was awesome. And then we started building big drones. So you saw the writing on the wall real early,
yeah.
I would say. So... was it because of the costs and the dangers that you saw with a real helicopter? Like, what made you switch to drones so hardcore so early?
Well, I think we were just talking the other day about who has more stick time flying RCs, you or me.
Right.
And obviously because I'm quite a bit older than you.
I think I got you. I'm sorry.
You definitely got me by a lot. But that's not to say that I didn't like spend like every penny I had and almost every waking moment of my childhood thinking about flying radio control airplanes.
Yeah, because you flew RC as a kid.
Right.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. Since I was like, 6 years old, I begged my dad for those stupid little...
control line.
Little control line things. Nice. That I'd be waking the neighbors up at 6 a.m.
With the little motor.
Yeah, brant, brant, brant. Yeah, starting those things up. And at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning, I'd be out there and the neighbors would be pissed.
Of course.
So anyways, from there, so awesome. You know, I would... and because I'd go on these shoots with my dad and help him out, I was making pretty good dough. Like, he would pay me like $75 a day for, like... of course, I'm sure he was charging a production company a couple hundred. But man, I was stoked at like 10, 12 years old to be making $75 because...
so did you
back
bring...
then, I would buy like... the first helicopter, like RC helicopter, back then they were like super expensive and
really,
and build these balsa, airplanes. And so that was like my thing growing up was flying and building radio controlled helicopters and planes. So I always dreamed of putting a camera on them. And
that's interesting. That's really interesting. So you allowed your hobby, I guess, to kind of merge in with your profession,
right?
I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
That's really cool. So when I started working with you early, so maybe 2011, 2012, we got some pretty big jobs right off the bat, flying the Red Epic, which at the time I think we were one of the few to fly a Red Epic on a helicopter or RC helicopter or a drone. I mean, we were shooting for like Oakley and Red Bull and Publix and
Dodge, and we were like
Ford.
Yeah, I know. I feel really fortunate that we got that, and I think it's probably a combination of my reputation in the film industry and the fact that, you know, I have the ear of producers in the area and out of town.
Sure.
So a lot of them knew me as an underwater guy. A lot of them knew me as a like boat photography guy. And so I was also able to say, oh, by the way, you know, check this out.
Right.
We got this set up now.
And, so cool.
Yeah.
It's so cool. So you mentioned earlier that when the GoPro came out, you saw the writing on the wall with what would happen to the underwater photography market. And it has happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's you said your underwater work is really slowed down.
Yeah.
And I remember we were on a shoot recently and they even asked you, oh, Jordy, you shoot underwater, right? And then, yeah, and you went through the bidding process. And then at the end of the day, they came back and said, oh, we just got the latest GoPro and did, it was only one shot. It was only one shot. So we just did it with a GoPro.
Yep.
And it was a big, it was a TV show or a feature. Yep. I mean, it was something pretty big.
And yeah, what really got me down was I, for 14 years straight, every year I could almost set my calendar to shooting the new SeaWorld commercials.
Okay.
I would, you know, sometimes go out to San Diego, Texas, you know, Orlando. And, 1 year it's about that time of year again around May, and I get a call. I mean, I don't get a call, but I start talking to my buddies that are saying, yeah, we're getting ready to do that SeaWorld commercial. And I'm like, oh, I'll give so-and-so a call. Mm-hmm. See why, maybe he just forgot to call me so far. So I call him and they're like, yeah, I hate to say this, but between liability of the whales and all that, we're just going to put a GoPro on a stick and put it over the side and Jeez. Just hope we get the shot. And I saw the commercial and I hate to say it, but it for the 3 seconds that they needed the shot, it was, it worked.
So
when I saw that, I'm like, well, that's the end of that.
And then it seems like you pivoted hard to aerials, both full sail.
Yeah.
Full
which I still do underwater. Yeah, but you've even been on a couple.
I know, underwater. I was a camera assistant.
Yeah.
Self-taught camera assistant on the day, on set.
Yep, on a big project.
Who was that with? Was that Fox?
Yeah.
That was for Fox?
Probably don't want to mention the name of the show.
Yeah, probably not. That was Fox. That was awesome. But so I guess where I was going with that question is, so you saw the writing on the wall. Do you now, in 2018... for example, the Mavic 2 just came out by DJI, which is a $1,300 prosumer drone, which shoots 4K, the beautiful like 1-inch sensor, beautiful, fully stabilized. So do you see with what you do now with your full-size aerials and professional-level aerials, you know, flying the big movie cameras, do you see that happening to the drone industry, or has it already happened?
Well, again, I'm really fortunate to work on some really high-end shoots with some really high-end directors and, and producers. So, yeah, the regional commercial market, like say the Best Buy commercials and you know, small regional Ford running footage commercials, things like that, they're perfectly happy with the lower cost, like the Inspire and.
You can shoot it with a Mavic almost.
Yeah,
and it's fine.
But fortunately, there's still the higher end productions always want the, like the Arri or Red.
Sure.
Like the episodics and theatrical release stuff.
Okay. So the high end work is still there.
Fortunately, for now. I think it's kind of barely hanging on by its fingernails, but.
Really? I mean, there's so many new drone companies coming out practically overnight where they can, you know, just depending on who you know, you don't need much RC knowledge now to get into it. So I feel like if you come from a background of being a producer and know the right connections, you can easily get a nice, easy to fly drone and end up being a drone pilot on a big movie set kind of overnight.
To an extent, but when you've got 100 people there, all standing around waiting, that's not a good, you know, you're putting, as a producer, you're putting your name on the line
right.
when you hire someone.
Right.
So if you call somebody from Craigslist, even though they're like, they've got this cool, you know, fully autonomous drone that can probably do the shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't know how to talk the talk. You know, they're not film set savvy. They don't know how to talk to directors. They don't know. You better bring like 12 sets of batteries because,
yeah,
you know, you can't just say, wait a minute, I got to charge this while there's 100 people standing around tapping their foot.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a certain amount of set etiquette that goes along with the ability to fly.
Yeah, that's a huge part. So coming in from the RC world, I knew nothing about this. And my first shoot with you after that Sea-Doo one, we shot like a big documentary. It was like 100 and something people on the call sheet. And so I learned everything I know about set etiquette from you. And I have to summarize it. The best piece of advice that your father gave to you and you passed down to me is always do something on set. Never just sit
even
around.
Even if it's wrong.
Right. Always do something on set, even if it's wrong. So, because there's nothing worse. If they call you to okay, drone, your report time is 6 a.m. So you get there at 6 a.m. And then it's a rush to shoot the sunrise. And of course, you kind of barely seem to get it. No matter how much you prepare, the sunrise shot and the sunset shots are always like a rush to get there. And then you nail it. But then after that, let's say, oh, we don't really need you till the rest of the day. And so if you just sit around and pretend, you know, just twiddle your thumbs and not doing much, then that way when they have to call you later on in the day and something happens, either you got to go grab an SD card or you got to get another battery, they're like, you guys have had all, you've right. been sitting around all day long. What is, so always do something even if it's wrong.
Yep.
I like that.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing, you know, I've had some of my guys, I always say you come dressed like a middle schooler. Try to wear, you know, nice attire as well and make sure that, you know, there's your equipment all looks good. Mm-hmm. Because it's fine if you show up and, you know, you're wearing your Def Leppard shirt or whatever or some sort, you know, and baggy, you know, board shorts or and flip-flops. That, yeah, that's all good that you're quirky and all that. But if something does go wrong... then the first thing the producer thinks of is like, these guys are a bunch of kooks.
Right.
They show up wearing board shorts and they're, you know, they got flip-flops on. Like, these guys don't take their job serious. What? Yeah. You know, but if you show up in a collared shirt with your name on the shirt and your cases are all really nice and cleaned up.
Sure.
You know, and you're all buttoned down and everything seems, you got a checklist there.
Sure.
And something goes wrong. At least at that point, you know, and you're making your best effort,
yes,
to get it going again. You're not just shrugging your shoulders and saying, well, I don't know what's wrong with it.
Right.
You know, which is what I feel that I'm synonymous for is I don't know that I've ever been completely, I don't think I've ever let the client down completely. We've always figured out a way to get the shot.
I totally agree. And after being on so many film shoots, something's always going to happen. Always. I mean, especially in an aerial department where if you're a drone on a film set, you are a camera department, you are a grip department, you are a transport, you're an electrical department. Literally, you are everything. And something always, always, always happens. It could be the most simple thing like one of your USB cables on your remote doesn't
HDMI
attach.
Or anything.
Yeah, your iPad needs an update.
Right.
Or, I mean, just one of a million things. And I feel like as I've seen through you on set, the biggest thing is just you have to just keep trying. You just keep trying. And things, mm-hmm. you just can't
and
get
producers phased. Appreciate that.
They do.
Yeah, you know, I honestly do. I mean, I've had them where something has went wrong. You know, like we did this shoot with Serena Williams, and they're paying her by the minute to be there.
God.
And all they wanted from us is they're doing the land scenes, you know, with the camera dolly and a crane of her playing tennis. The commercial's running right now. I can't remember what it's. It's like it's a medical. Yeah, I think it's a medical, some sort of pill or something that medication thing.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, they're like the producer comes over and says, "Okay, we're going to have you shoot in like 38 minutes. Okay. And they had us get there at 6 a.m. and it's like 11:30 or 12 by now. And they're like, all right, 38 minutes. We're going to, okay. So just make sure you're completely ready. So we get the drone out, set it all up, test flew it twice.
You know, what were you flying? What kind of drone?
This was just a little DJI Inspire 2.
Inspire 2. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the only shot they wanted
was to fly up. We even did a test flight before she got there and found what lens they wanted, what focal length, the altitude, the exact position of the drone.
Had it nailed.
Yeah, had it nailed. That's exactly where they want. Okay, perfect. So we land it, and we're just standing there, chomping at the bit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, okay.
From 38 minutes.
Right, we're like hands, thumbs on the sticks, ready to go.
Yeah.
And so the producer looks over at me, gives us the thumbs up. And give, you know, points his thumb up in the air, which meant, you know, to take off. We cross the sticks, and it says, mandatory update required.
Oh, my God. So what'd you do?
We waited 15 minutes for the... I don't know what that cost production, but I look over and I see... I see Serena Williams just sitting there with her legs crossed, sitting on the tennis court.
Just hanging out.
Yep. On her phone, you know, texting.
Jeez. But it's always something. Always. Yeah. And that's the thing. You could have the most high-end, I mean, even on our super high-end drones, too. It's always something. And so what's the saying? If you got one, you got none.
Right.
So we always bring multiple on set and make sure we're good there. But, yeah, that's... Man, by the minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to that producer.
Yeah, but then they called us back and says, hey, we got another shoot coming up, and we're supposed to do a Lincoln commercial with them coming up. They're like, yeah, we realize stuff like that happens. And
sure.
We just did a shoot with another drone company, and they forgot the whole control box. You know, like some crazy thing.
And that happens too.
And then someone else I heard just... they said that they flew the drone and hit the talent. So, but anyways, yeah.
But, you know, another thing that we ran into, I mean, so we've done about, I counted it a few months ago, we've done over 100 shoots together.
Really?
Not shooting days, over 100 individual shoots.
That's so pretty, maybe even more than 100 days.
Right. All drone. Everything drone. One underwater with you.
Right.
And then there was another day, super quick. There was another day I shot with you where you did, where the same camera, we had a Red Epic, so a whatever, $30,000 camera. By the time you're loaded, what, 50 or whatever?
Yeah.
So we had a $50,000 camera go from underwater to aerials in 15 minutes.
And then we have to put it on a crane, too.
Yeah, and then that poor camera got to work out that day. But, yeah, so we've done like 100 shoots together. And knock on wood, we've never... had a crash or anything like that.
Yep.
And at this point, the statistics are unlikely that
we can
that you can continue that. But I do have to say that we had an interesting run-in with a big. We were on a big movie, shooting up in Atlanta, and the director, whatever it was, director of photography, asked us to do a shot that was really unsafe. Mm-hmm. Let's just say. Flying near and over a crowd of people.
Yep.
And
indoors.
So FAA rules, there's no rule. Like that's not against the rules. Yep. FAA, because you're inside. There's really no rules.
Yep.
But you know, you and I talked, and you know, you kind of left the decision up to me, and you're like, I don't know, man, this doesn't look good. But you make the call. And so I remember this is so ridiculous. So it was a big crowd of people. Director said, I want you, the Mr. Drone Pilot, I want you to fly from the back all the way up to the front of the stage. And I said, sorry, I can't fly over a crowd of people. I'm not going to do that. And he's like, okay, well, how big is the drone in diameter? Remember this?
Yep, I remember.
And we're like 6 feet, 10, you know, 10 feet with the propellers fully extended. But so call it, you know, eight feet or whatever.
Right.
The dude takes out a tape measure. Remember that?
Yep.
Tape measure, splits the crowd up. So the whole production stops for this. And he takes a tape measure and he splits us up. 8 feet. 8 feet.
No, I think he said something like, I'll give you 6 feet.
Right.
Yeah. He wouldn't give us a full, and he says, take it or leave, you know.
Yeah. And so we look at it and I was like, dude, this is just so not cool. This is not good. This is not good.
It was probably the one of the most stressful drone shoots.
And it
that
and,
particular point.
And I give you credit for this was like your this was like you on the line here, your company on the line. And I just told you, like, dude, I'm not going to do the shot. You can get someone else to fly this, but I'm not doing it. And you had my back, which I really appreciated. But then the coolest thing happened. The producer came over. So the producer, who's head honcho on
set. His name's,
Yeah. So he comes over and just discusses the shot with us and said, you know what, guys? Like, I really appreciate you putting safety first. That's cool. You know what? No big deal. Like, we'll get the shot another day. I really appreciate it. And the director and director of photography were pissed.
Oh, they were coming unsoldered.
And we're like, that's it. We're done. Like, we're fired. Yeah. That's it. So literally, we got another shot, but we went home. And then we're like, okay, well, I guess we'll never hear from them ever again. But you know what happened a few months later? That same producer called us up and said, hey, I really admire you guys.
Yeah.
You know, doing the right thing and flying safely. And they got us on a episodic that's been shooting.
Yep, we've been doing like every week we've been doing a shoot.
It's been great. So I guess I wanted to throw that story in there for...
Yeah, that's a good story for sure.
For the pilots out there. So maybe if there's drone pilots listening who like have your 107 and you're doing some shoots here and there that I really think that maybe half the time it would have gone the other way where they'd say, we're not hiring these guys again. They won't do this shot that they said they could pull off or something. But I think it was really cool that they respected us for that and didn't, you know, and even hired us again.
And then what was weird was shortly after that shoot, mm-hmm. we were doing a test flight.
The next flight.
The next, like literally. Like one or two after that.
Literally.
We go to take off and... One motor crapped out,
yeah,
right?
Number seven ESC crapped out. It was an Octo. Seven ESC. And so we can still fly.
Yep.
But it started spinning.
Right.
And I landed.
Right. But had that have happened...
Oh, my God.
It would have been questionable if you would have...
Oh, my God. Yeah. Like, that was so scary. So, I don't know. I think... And we've been asked a lot to overfly a lot of people. Like, that happens a lot. That's the biggest, like, kind of no-no that we always tell.
And you watch other... Like, you go on YouTube and you just see that. I can't even watch it.
Yeah.
It's worse than those skateboarders going down there trying to slide the handrail and they land backwards on the steps and slide down the whole flight of steps. I'd rather watch that than just somebody flying a drone over a crowd of people.
And I wonder it too. If you go to like Instagram and scroll through drone photos, so many of them, like, they're beautiful shots where it's 1,000 feet in the air. Over the middle of a highway, like, intersection where it's geometrically really cool looking.
Yeah.
But, like, how are you doing that legally? Like, you are not. And so, I don't know. I feel like we just, maybe we play it too safe.
Yeah. But, you know, again, the people that want to force the issue, we'd rather just assume that. I'd rather take the high road and just say, maybe you should call that. The guy from Craigslist that will fly right over the people. And
we've told them that.
Yep.
And sometimes they do actually. They get the shot, but not by us. So what would you say to someone who's maybe in the film industry or in any capacity, camera operator, drone operator, whatever, maybe airplane pilot who would want to fly planes around with cameras attached to them? What would you say to someone who wants to get into the film industry? Like, what's it like? How's the work-life balance? What would you recommend for them? Someone wanting to get in the film industry.
Well, don't let what you see on television fool you. It's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
We have a saying, but I can't really say it right now. But
okay.
It's just not all.
It's not what you
think. It's not a day at the beach, let's say.
Right.
Even if it is a day at the beach. It's not going to be a day at the beach because you're going to be, you know, sweating your butt off working.
Right.
So if you're in it because you think it's glamorous and an easy job and you just sit around and yell action and cut, don't get into the movie business because nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
It's probably the hardest job. You know, I worked as I started off. My dad had this air compressor company when I was younger. And at one time, I thought I wanted to be a mechanical engineer and work for that company. And I worked every position in that company, from assembling the compressors to designing them, mm-hmm. to the welding, to the painting, to the machine shop. And so I worked in each capacity for quite a while. And then I had some other outside jobs growing up. And I could tell you, the by far the hardest job is the motion picture industry.
Yeah.
Mentally and physically.
I would totally agree. And it seems like the stress level always reaches maximum at some point in the day. Always.
And people are, and because it's like that, you have to have a passion for it. Mm-hmm. And because whenever you deal with people that are passionate about their work, they want to try to do the best job possible. And then if you interfere, or something that somebody does interferes with their vision, mm-hmm. There's going to be, sparks are going to fly, so to speak, as far as people are going to get upset.
Sure.
And you got to have a thick skin. A lot of times, people will yell at you. And
screamers.
Screamers. Yeah. And a lot of times at the end of the shoot, you get the shot and they'll come up and say, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry. I just kind of lost it there at the end." And then sometimes they don't. But
jeez.
You can't have a thin skin. You just got to be able to work really hard, do the best you can, and be a problem solver. That's the big thing.
Man, I totally agree. And it seems like it's always feast or famine with the film world.
Yep.
Either you got nothing going on or you got 10 projects and you need to figure out a way to make it happen. So your wife, Arlene, as you mentioned, she was a stunt double. She was, wasn't she Daryl Hannah's?
Yeah, in the movie Splash.
So she was her double.
That's kind of how we hooked up.
That's so cool. So she's obviously extremely understanding of you being in, but this is a hard industry, especially if you have like a family. If you're on a feature for 6 months.
Yep. And I feel that anybody that is in this industry, I don't know how people stay married if they're not married to somebody that has been or is in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you call them up at night and it's 11:30 and you say, "Hey," you try to talk real quiet. I can't really talk too loud because we're still on set right now. I just stepped away. And then, your spouse would say something like, "So let me get this straight. You started at 6:30 this morning,
mm-hmm.
and it's 11 o'clock at night right now. And you're trying to tell me that you've been working nonstop all day." I'm like, we had a half hour lunch and everything. So you're trying to tell me that you work, who would believe something like that?
And you're right. You're absolutely right. And then even if they go into penalties and overtime and you still have to shoot at the end of the day.
Right. And especially if you're renting a museum or they have to close a road and they only have a permit for one day.
Right.
There's no choice, but you have to shoot it all, and no matter how many hours it takes.
Well, I think that's really about all I got for you. So between scuba, pilot, helicopter crashes, what else? Any other great Geordieisms? You have a million stories that are, I'll definitely have to get you back on sometime. Your dad is another
two-time thing. Academy Award-winning dad, so that didn't hurt.
Yeah. Your dad has... I was lucky enough to listen to a 2-hour interview with him for a book he was trying to get done.
You got
to
do one of these podcasts with him.
I will. Yeah, I'll get him on because your dad's a character. 91?
Four.
94?
Yeah.
Is he?
Yep.
I mean,
just turning 94.
I know he just bought, or when he reached 90, he sold his seaplane to then buy a speedboat that goes 90 miles an hour.
Because he wanted to go 90 miles an hour in his boat on his 90th birthday.
But then you were driving the boat and you hit something.
No, that was the next thing.
Oh, right.
He got tired of that boat and he bought an airboat.
Oh, that's
because
right.
Because we live on a lake and we have weeds out front.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "You know what? I'm going to sell this stupid speedboat and buy an airboat. And I'm going to design a weed removal system to bolt onto the airboat and get rid of all these weeds."
That's awesome.
And so he let me drive it while he was a passenger.
In the front. He was on the front.
Yeah, and I was trying to scare him, but I got a little bit too close to the dock, and I just clipped the edge of the dock, and he flipped out. and his head went right in the mud.
So your 94-year-old father went flying out of the boat.
Yeah, that was horrible.
Into the mud. And he was fine.
Yeah, he got up and he called, he's, again, been in the Navy, so he's not afraid to throw some four-lettered words around. But I heard a few of those his head out of the mud.
All right, that's awesome. All right, cool. So for people who are listening now, if they want to look up maybe some of your work or see what you've done or follow you, how can they see what you've done and what you're up to?
Well, you could look at jordy.com. That's jordy.com. Or xcam, the letter X, cam, aerials.com.
Make sure you type in aerials, not xcam.com. But xcamaerials.com.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Otherwise, you'll see another thing that I have no part of. But I'd probably be doing a lot better financially if I did have xcam.com.
You probably would be.
But anyways, and then, of course, Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff.
All right, cool. Well, we'll have to have some people. Maybe, guys, if you're listening and you have any questions for Jordy, if you want to write in comments on my page, on my Facebook page, Watts Innovations, want to look that up, then I'll pass them along to Jordy or however you can get a hold of either of us. We'd love to answer any questions you guys might have, and I'll definitely have to get you on here another time. And future guests, most of them that I have in mind right now really come from knowing you, so you're kind of the center of this world, that's for sure.
Yep.
Wild dude. All right, my friend, well, thank you for coming on the show.
Respect.
And that was a high five if you couldn't hear it. And all right, well, thank you guys for listening. This was the first one. This is definitely fun. And stay tuned for episode numero dos.
That's two, right?
That is two.
Right.
All right, thanks.
So there you have it. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. I sure did. I really enjoyed sitting down and having a chat with Jordy. His story is just absolutely incredible. So if you enjoyed it, if you got some value out of it, would definitely appreciate it if you could share it with your friends, throw it on social media, pass it around, whatever it takes. I would really, really appreciate it. As I mentioned, I've got some other guests in mind kind of already lined up for some future episodes here. And if you guys know of anyone's story that's really incredible and want to tell it, then hit me up. I'd love to have you on the show. No real specifics here, just if it's a compelling story and you're into kind of tech, DIY, entrepreneurship, drones, cameras, that kind of thing, I would definitely love to have you. So thank you guys for listening so much. Really do appreciate it once again, and I will catch you guys next time for episode 2. Thanks. See ya.